All right. Well, we talked about we did talk about verse 1 last week, just kind of as an introduction, that this dragon, which is Satan, is identified as Satan. He brings this beast out of the sea. This beast coming out of the sea means it's coming out of the mass of humanity, the sea of humanity, you might say. It has 10 horns, which indicates power, 7 heads, which is probably a mockery. Honestly, there's a lot of mockery going on here in chapter 13 in particular. And we'll see that later on in some of the other chapters as well. The mockery being that Satan uses things of God like numbers or crowns or you know, just other things I'll point out here in just a moment to imitate God, but always falling short of what God does. On his horns were 10 diadems, again, crowns. And then on his heads were blasphemous names. What's blasphemy mean? Just so we're clear. Lori? Okay, denying God in the face of evidence. Okay. Or? And or?
Saying that you are God.
Saying that you are God when you're not. That's blasphemy. Okay, so defiance of God, defiance of God's identity. Just as a most basic sense, blasphemy is profaning anything that is holy or sacred. That's really what it means, is profaning. We think of profanity, we think of curse words, but what profanity really is a profaning of the English language in its most basic sense, and that's why we call it profanity. Well, this is profanity, but it's religious profanity. It's not like swear words, but it's things that contradict God or defy him or undermine his authority. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet like those of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion. So we have this beast that is animal-like, animalistic, okay? Which is interesting because when you see men come up with kingdoms and nations and powers, they're animal-like or they're of the earth. Remember Nebuchadnezzar's statue was metallic, metals of the earth. And then Daniel chapter 7, which we had studied not terribly long ago, we saw several beasts representing each of the four kingdoms. They're animal-like. So when men defy God, when they blaspheme God, they descend downward into an animal-like state. So it makes sense that we see them in an animal-like caricature or animal-like representation. Okay? And if you read Romans 1, which a lot of people go to for this point here, and rightly so, Romans chapter 1, Paul talks about those who do not honor God and are ungrateful, and it talks about them descending downward spiritually and sexually. Okay, they descend downward into an animal-like state, actually even lower than animals, because he talks about men committing acts with men and women committing acts with women that are improper and indecent. Even animals don't do that. Okay, animals know better than to, you know, procreate male and female and so on. But people get below that in their animal-like thinking. So all that to say is that this is an animal-like representation, which means these people are a base people, a depraved people, whoever they are that they're representing. And I believe that this is really representing the power of the Roman Empire, the imperial power of the Roman Empire. This is really talking about the emperors or the kings or the kingly power itself. I'm not certain that it's always talking about specific kings, although that too, but it's talking about the kingly or imperial power. And by imperial, I just mean really the emperor's power here. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. Okay? So here we have an actual photograph of the beast coming out of the sea. Just so in case anyone was wondering what it looked like there. So there are a lot of portrayals out there. If you just Google in beast coming out of the sea, you'll get all kinds of things. And the only reason I went for this one is because it's got high res. Okay, so that was a leading factor here. So anyway, but imagine what John is seeing. I mean, just stop for a minute and think about John seeing all these things. I mean, imagine seeing a beast like that coming out of the sea and coming toward you, coming onto land. I mean, that would be a terrifying thing to see. So we kind of take it in stride. We go, okay, John saw this, and then he saw that, and he saw this. We don't really think about what it is that he's seeing. And the fact that is that he is in this vision, seeing these things as they're unfolding, and it has to be terrifying. It's like watching a nightmare, in a sense. If it were not for God in control of the situation, this would be horrifying to watch this. Jim? Yes. Right. Yeah, it is. It's misleading.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's not, I mean, John isn't literally seeing an actual monster. He's seeing something that's portrayed as a monster, right? And yet a lot of people go to the dragon thing. This is where our premillennialist friends, those who believe in the pre-1,000-year reign of Christ that we're in right now, allegedly, this is where they start going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Literal, figurative, almost every other verse. Well, this is literal. Well, this is figurative. Well, this is literal. In this case, this is figurative. But in the next breath, they're going to talk about what is literal. And so they keep going back and forth. Remember what we said early on in the study is that context is our guide. It's the context that tells us when we go literal or figurative. And the rule of thumb is we always are literal unless the context tells us otherwise. So the literal reading is the go-to, unless, of course, we're in a different context. And we are. We're in a vision. We're in a visionary state, so the context is different. We shouldn't be taking things literal unless John, every once in a while, as I said before, he kind of steps out of the picture and says, this is what this is. This is what this is. And he does that, actually, in this particular passage very... let's see, very soon here. Yes, and I just came up with it. He talks about the tabernacle. And why can't I find it? Because I was looking at so many other things. Oh, right here, it's in verse 6. And he opens his mouth and blasphemies against God. This is what this beast is doing, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle. That is, and that's inserted by the translators here, that word that is, but John is saying those who dwell in heaven. So he's telling you what the tabernacle is. He's kind of saying, and his tabernacle, by the way, those who dwell in heaven are the tabernacle. It's really what he's doing here. So now we know. We know a literal identification of what God means when he says tabernacle in this context. So later on, when, like in Revelation chapter 20, this tabernacle comes up again, it says that God dwells in his tabernacle, in the heavenly realm, we know that what he's really talking about is he dwells among his people who are in heaven. His people are the tabernacle. So now we know, because John said so. All right, so we do want to get back up here and talk about this dragon, gives him power. This dragon is of course, Satan giving him this power. Where is Satan to get his power from? People. Remember, we've been saying this. Satan has no power unless you give it to him. He has no power in your life unless you give it to him. That's why James says in James 4:8, draw near to God and he'll draw near to you and Satan will flee from you, right? Because Satan cannot contend with God's power and presence. And if you are filled with Christ and filled with the Holy Spirit and you are walking with God, walking in the light, Satan cannot do anything to you. I'm not saying that you'll never be tempted, and I'm not saying that you can't fall. What I'm saying is that in that state, right there, you are protected from him. But so much of the world gives its allegiance to Satan, and so therefore Satan becomes, of course, very powerful. Another thing we should notice before we move on here, this beast here is coming out of the sea. Where did Christ come out of? Came out of heaven. So this beast is coming from below. Christ came down from above. So there's that contrast, that mimicking, you know, that he's coming out of something. And when we think of a sea, we think of something hidden, mysterious, obscure, because once you get down below the water, it's a different world. And so there's this idea of this beast coming out of something hidden. Well, Jesus came out of something hidden to us and obscure to us, but on a very transcendent level from what we see here of like an ocean or a sea. Of course, remember, this is not a real sea anyway. So there's a part of the mockery. Again, 10, as we mentioned here, we'll see in our numbers class. We're doing a study on numerology, by the way, right now. And a lot of the numerology that we're studying has to do with the book of Revelation. So if you really want to get into the number side of things, then stick with our class on biblical numerology, which is the first and third Sunday evenings of the month. So we have 10, which means fullness or completion. Typically, traditionally, it's thought of as two hands with 10 fingers, meaning it's a world, it's a man-made or a man origin power. It's a power of men. So when we see that 10, that's usually what that means. And so we're seeing here again, of course, mockery of one thing or another, because this isn't God's power, this is Satan's power. And everything that Satan does is a mockery. So this beast really is a composite, as we see these different animals here in verse 2. It's a composite. If you look back in Daniel 7, we saw other beasts, and then they all kind of came together in that monster beast. You remember that? And that monster beast was undefined and unimaginably horrible and strong and all that, and we talked about that as being Rome. This beast derives its power from the dragon. Christ's authority is derived from God, is not from the people. This is where Satan and Christ are diametrically opposed positions as well. Satan gets all his power from people. The dragon, or the beast, gets its power from the dragon. But Christ has his power inherently because he is the Son of God, and also because he has been given delegated authority by his Father, who has power over everything. So very much not even close as far as where the source of power comes from. Okay, so we should at this point make a distinction as to what's going on as far as this imitation that I was talking about. For example, we have God on one side, and then we have Satan, who is a god. He's the god of this world. Isn't there a verse somewhere in the New Testament that says that? There is a verse that says that somewhere in the New Testament, that he is the god of this world. And by the way, that's in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 3 and 4, where Paul identifies him as the god of this world. And then we have God the Son, and then as a mockery or an imitation of that, we have the son of, remember Satan is a dragon, we have the son of the dragon, which is the beast. This is his creation. This is what he put together. This is what he, you know, formed. And to come out of the water here, which really isn't his at all. He didn't create it out of nothing. God creates things out of nothing. Satan's using parts that are already made, if you want to think about it that way. We also have God the Spirit. And we're going to see very soon here we have this false prophet, which Satan also puts together or brings to life or gives power here. We have really Christ's resurrection from the dead, and we're going to see very soon here a false resurrection, a kind of resurrection. One of the heads of the beast is going to be slain. That word slain in Greek literally means slaughtered with the sword, slaughtered to death. So it's not a natural death. In other words, it's not a, like he just got old and died kind of death. It's a death by the sword. And then we're going to see, as we saw in chapter 7, those who belong to God are sealed of God, and then those who belong to Satan are, what's happening later in chapter 13? They're going to be marked. with the mark of that beast that we just read about. They're going to take on that identity there. And then we also have, we're not done yet, one more. They have the bride of Christ, which is what? The church. And then we have over here on this side who? Who's the mimicry of the bride of Christ? The harlot, right? The great harlot, the mother of harlots, the one who sits upon the beast and drinks the cup of the blood of the saints, right? I mean, that all comes out here in chapter 17. It's just a wicked, vile woman in comparison to the holy and pure vision of God's bride here. So we do see a great difference here. And so we want to recognize that. We want to make sure that we're recognizing that everything Satan is doing is just an imitation, a inferior imitation, not an equal, but an inferior imitation of what God has already done, what he's already brought out in his scripture here. All right. So let's get back to our actual text here. I saw one of the heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed, and the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. And they worshiped the dragon, Satan, because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worshiped, excuse me, the beast, saying, who is like this beast who is able to wage war with him? In other words, he's so powerful. He's invincible. No one can stop him. Or really, no one can stop it. Okay. Remember what this beast is, as I said, by implication, and this will come out, that this is really talking about an imperial power. It's really talking about the power of the emperors themselves, because that is what is controlling Rome. That is what's controlling the Roman Empire, and that is what's going to wage war against the Christians, against the church. It's not the Roman people that do this, it's the Roman state. And who is running the state? The emperors are running the state here. So this death of this head here, many have come to believe that this refers to the death of one of the emperors, and then him coming alive doesn't mean that he literally resurrects from the dead, but someone resurrects or comes to life or is put in power that is very much like him who died. And as I give you here in my notes, page 13, chapter 13, page 13, who knew, right? And so on page 13, I do give you there what I believe is going on here, and that is that Nero is that head that was slain. And Nero did die a violent death. How did Nero die, by the way? By the sword, okay? He died violently by the sword. And the resurrection of Nero isn't literal. It's not like Nero literally came back to life, but someone comes back to life who did what Nero did, who is like who Nero was like, who really has the same nature, character, anti-God, blasphemous against God kind of attitude, and that hates the saints or finds them to be expendable, at least, just like Nero did. Now, they have different reasons for why they did these things. Nero was just an egomaniac, and Domitian, later on, who I'm referring to in the spirit of Nero, he reigned at the time that John is writing this here, in the 90s of the first century, in the very end of the first century. He also was an egomaniac, but he had a sense of greatness about him that even superseded that of Nero. Nero's power didn't last for long because Nero basically went insane. A lot of people believe he had syphilis or something of that sort, some kind of sexually transmitted disease that caused him to go mad. And it's probably true. Okay, given the state of how he lived and how he indulged sexually and otherwise in his life. And Domitian was just mad with power, you might say. Mad with himself, or crazy with him, his own self, and trying to exalt himself constantly. And so you have this beast who is killed, or this head rather, that is killed and then is regenerated or reborn as a different man, but with the same attitude. That fits the picture. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't other views out there. There certainly are. I just don't agree with them. Because at some point, you have to start cramming things in here that just don't fit. I'm trying to be as natural about the text as I can. And what is the text naturally leading us to conclude here? The text is telling us a story or telling us an account, and we're trying to stay with that as best as we can. To this new head that is reborn out of the head that died, there was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies and authority to act for 42 months. We've seen this 42 months before. What does 42 months equal? 3.5 years, right? Which is really the best designation for it. So half of 7, which means something that is imperfect, something that is limited in time, in scope, in power, something limited, but also it implies often a very difficult time. 42 months is never portrayed as a good time. It's always portrayed with some sense of difficulty or trial or even persecution. And we see that in Domitian, not 42 months literally on the calendar, but we see him having a limited time in which he does exactly what we see right here. Domitian was a very arrogant man, and he thought himself to be God. In fact, he wanted everyone to refer to him as the Son of God, or simply as a divine being. He wanted people to worship him, not just to obey him as an emperor. He wanted to be worshipped as a God, as a divine being. And so he would speak out against anyone who would dare to challenge his authority or challenge who he thought he was here. And he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God, verse 6, to blaspheme God himself, but also God's people. Now, there's distinction made here. First of all, God's people in heaven, and then, verse 7, and to make war with God's people on earth. The saints are those who are on earth. So you've got God in his tabernacle, in the midst of his people in heaven, and then you've got the saints here who are on the earth. And Domitian has no problem just going against both of them, both groups, and exalting himself in the presence of both of them and assuming that he is more powerful than any of them are. There's something that's said about false prophets that is fitting right here. And Domitian fits the bill, even though he's not defined as a false prophet, but he is, in essence. He's a false teacher. I mean, anyone who claims to be God obviously is a false teacher, whether it's over religious issues or not. It says, 2 Peter 2, talking about false teachers and false prophets, daring, self-willed, they do not tremble when they revile angelic majesties. Well, that really is, you know, Domitian right there. And other emperors that followed him later on kind of had that same sort of very arrogant, extremely arrogant, egomaniac kind of attitude there. And it even says that these are like unreasoning animals born as creatures of instinct to be captured and killed, reviling where they have no knowledge. And this is, again, very descriptive of what we're seeing in this head of this beast that has come to life and is waging war against God, waging war against God's people in heaven, and now waging war, declaring war, in essence, against God's church on earth. And as we have said before in this class and even in our Old Testament studies, whenever any person or nation declares war on God's people, God steps in ultimately and says, well, your battle isn't really with these people, it's really with me. And now we're going to go head to head and you're going to lose. You're just going to just be destroyed because of that. Because no one can go against God and win. I mean, to oppose God is to seal your own fate. It is to really give up your life and of course your soul as well. Okay, so that is what I believe is going on here, and he has a limited amount of time to act, and so that brings on a certain intensity when you have only 42 months or a limited time in which to do whatever it is you're going to do. That ramps up the intensity of whatever it is that you're doing, because you're going to try to get it done as quickly as possible. So the beast's objective here, as we're seeing in starting in verse 7, is to make war with the saints and to overcome them. There was the idea in the first century in particular that the church originally was just another sect of the Jews. And until AD 70, when Jerusalem was destroyed, that's how the Romans and the Roman state saw the church. They just saw it as kind of a break-off sect or a branch off of Judaism, kind of an extreme, you know, cult or group or, you know, whatever you want to call it from Judaism. Well, when Jerusalem was destroyed and Judaism was destroyed with it, I mean, the practice of Judaism was destroyed with the destruction of Jerusalem. But the Christianity, it survived. In fact, it flourished, and it just spread all over the empire. And then the Roman state realized that Christianity is no longer associated with Judaism. Christianity is a religion in its own right. And what does Christianity talk about that you, if you were a Roman emperor, you might find rather offensive? What does Christianity talk about? A different king. Not only that, but what? What do we do with this king? We serve him. We worship him. We worship him above all other kings. He is a supreme king to Christians, right? And that means that if you are the emperor of Rome and you hear about these Christians worshiping some supreme king who is greater than yourself in Rome, what do you think you're going to do about that? You're going to try to stamp that out. And that's exactly what they did. They tried to stamp out Christianity. Not just because they were insulted by that point I just made, but also because they didn't want any kind of new religion brought into the empire. There was a law against any new religion, and the Christians, they believe, were breaking that law. Now, if you listen to Paul's arguments, and he's arguing before Roman proconsuls or Roman governors, in the book of Acts, in some of his trials, before Felix and Festus and Agrippa, right? He's arguing before Roman authorities, and he argues that this religion, known as the Way or Christianity, is simply a continuation of what was already started much, way back in the time of Moses. So he's arguing there, in essence, this is not a new religion. This is a religion that has always been here. And it's a religion that really is the extension of, or the continuation of, what God has already started back through Moses and the prophets. If you read his arguments there, what he's really saying is, this is not an illegal religion. This is not a religion that is illegal to practice in Rome. This is not a religion to overthrow Rome. Remember what Jesus said about his kingdom? That it is not of this earth. This kingdom that he's talking about is spiritual in nature or transcendent in nature. It's above us all. And yes, we do worship Christ as king above all other kings. By the way, we today worship Christ, I hope, above every president or king or monarch or whatever else is out there. We worship Christ above all those things, but that doesn't put us in contradiction to those kings, because we have our king, our citizenship that is here on earth, but we look forward to a citizenship that is there with God in heaven. So we're kind of operating on two different planes here. But if you're not a spiritual person and you don't know your Bible at all, or you don't know anything about God, you might hear things like this and take it very wrongly, and that would create conflict and great disturbances there, and then your solution might be to just stamp it all out. Then you have this man, Domitian, who thinks that he's God. And in order to be God, I mean, in order to be the God, you have to have power and authority over all other alleged gods, whether they exist or not. And so here the Christians are worshiping God in heaven, and Domitian is basically saying that he is God in heaven while on earth. Well, now we have a problem. And that's what the Christians are facing. Remember, this is written to the seven churches that are in Asia. Don't forget that tie, that historical context. And the seven churches of Asia are in the midst of, in Asia Minor, are in the midst of imperial, popular imperial support. Let me say it that way. That the people there, the Romans there, the citizens there, are very much in support of the emperor. They do not care whether he is a god or not. They're just going to pinch the incense to him and say, you know, hail emperor, the divine son of God, because they just want to save their necks. And the Christians can't do that. Not without betraying who they are and who they worship. And the same would be for us today. I mean, if our president were to ever say, well, you're going to either worship me or obey me, absolutely. In other words, no matter what, you're going to obey me or you're going to face your execution. And we would have to say, well, you know, we obey God no matter what. And that is our king. Christ is our king. That is who we're going to listen to. And so we would be put in a very similar situation as these Christians were. So imagine the Christians. I was thinking about this today, kind of going over the notes, and imagine the Christians reading all this stuff that we're reading right now. We're reading it in hindsight. We're reading it 2,000 years later. We're reading it in the comfort of a air-conditioned, well-lit church building. We're reading it without Roman imperialists coming and knocking on our doors and holding guns to our heads and, you know, hauling us all off to prison. We're reading it really comfortably. But imagine reading this knowing that this is your future. That this is what you're going to be facing soon enough. That would be just terrifying, wouldn't it? Unless, of course, you had great faith in God and were believing that God was going to take you through this no matter what. No matter what it costs you, God's going to take you through it. Imagine then if we were facing that right now, that we knew in the near future that we are going to have governing authorities coming in here with assault weapons and all kinds of force and brutality, and we knew that this was going to happen. And what kind of people would we be here? What kind of message do you suppose we'd be talking about? What kind of preaching would be done? What kind of exhortation would we be offering one another? You see what I'm talking about? We wouldn't be quibbling over the issues. We wouldn't be quibbling over things like, you know, eating in the building or, you know, do we wear veils over our heads or not? Or is it one cup or many cup? All those little things that become very petty in nature when you think about it. We wouldn't be worried about any of those things. What would we be concerned with is we have got to get through this, and we're going to get through it together, and we're going to get through it no matter what it costs us, and when it's over, we will be with God. That would change the dynamic of our preaching right away, wouldn't it? So I have to imagine that these Christians, as they read this revelation that John sees, and they're reading through this, and I just imagine the church leadership looking out across the people and saying, okay, people, now we know what we're up against. Now we know what we need to do, and we're going to have to be strong. It's going to get ugly. It's going to get worse before it gets better, but we can get through this. Right? Any thoughts on that? Jim, you got any thoughts on that? You look like you do. Go ahead. Well, when you're talking about he's given authority, it's the beast that's given authority, right? The dragon gave him power and his throne and great authority. So he's deriving that from Satan. So we really have the imperial powers, the emperors themselves, who are getting their authority to do these things. Not their imperial or state authority, but their authority to speak out against God and declare war against God's saints. They're getting that authority from really Satan. It's a satanic authority. Now, where does Satan get his authority? Well, you might say that God does grant him a certain measure of authority. You might say that. And we have said that he derives his power from the people. But he does have an authority to exist, and he has authority to be who he is, and that has to be given to him from God, because if God didn't give him that, then he wouldn't exist. So God allows for certain entities to exist, just like he does on the earth today. Okay, I mean, there's a lot of godless nations in the world today. They're ruled by godless religions. They're ruled by despots. They're ruled by totalitarian parties and people that have no concern for human life. And God allows those people to rule. He allows it. He's not supportive of it. He's not endorsing it for 1 minute. But he does give them an authority. All authority is derived from God ultimately. Right.
And not that he created that. He didn't create Satan that way. Satan decided to be that way by his
right.
choice. So he uses that as his tool, so to speak, to say, okay, I'll let him be on the adversary, and you can make a choice whether you're going to follow him or follow me.
That is true.
And that's the authority that's given there, because he has allowed choice to be there for a while, and choice to be, I guess, be there all the time.
Yeah. That's true. And God is always providing a choice for us. So that's what this is all about, is a choice.
It's like Job on a much larger scale.
In a sense.
Satan went after a man of God. In Job, he's going after the people of God here and persecuting them the way that he persecuted Job.
Right. Right. Well, Satan's going after the wrong people. Remember we said that when he allowed that river of lies and deceptions, the end of chapter 12, that river was to destroy God's people. Whereas the flood back in Genesis was to destroy the godless. So God is always taking out the right people. Right, so to speak. I mean, God is destroying sinners who choose to be sinners and don't want to be anything but sinners. That's who God destroys. But Satan is going after people of God. He's going after God's saints. So it's a completely different attack, different strategy here. It was given to make war with the saints and to overcome them. Okay, and authority over every tribe and people and tongue. Meaning, really, everyone that is in the empire. That's what that phrase means, every tribe, people, tongue, and nation. All that conglomerate of nations that have been vanquished by the Roman state are all brought together as the empire. So the empire is really this kind of a hodgepodge. It's a tightly knit, at this point, hodgepodge, but it's still a hodgepodge of different peoples, nationalities, cultures, tribes, nations that have been defeated, and so on. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, worship this head, everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life. Okay, so think about that there is this book of life. This comes up later on, right? Chapter 20, the end of chapter 20, that the books are opened and the book of life is opened. And if your name is not found in the book of life, well, it's going to be really bad for you. If I could just say it gently. And so here we have those people identified here. We have two groups of people, in essence. We have those whose names are written in the book of life, and we have everyone else. So we have those who are identified by God, identified with God, identified to God, and then we have everyone else. It's kind of like the narrow path and everything else, right? The wide path is everything else. Yeah, those who walk in the light, those who walk in darkness, those who walk in the truth, and those who walk according to lies. So we have very distinct people who are distinctly identified, and it's always a small group in comparison to the rest, right? You'll never see God's people being the dominant number, always a smaller number. But nonetheless, the right number. In other words, the proper people, the people that are identified by God. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. Where have we heard that before? Well, we heard that several times in the letters. Remember, Jesus said that in the letters to the churches. Now he's, in essence, through John, saying it again. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. Remember, Jesus in his ministry would say things like that. He who has an ear, let him hear to what I'm telling you. In other words, if you got an ear, you should be listening up. And that means that whatever is being said is to be heard and accepted as the truth. Verse 10 is a bit cryptic, I know. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. The best that I can come up with in looking at a number of different points of view on this here is kind of what Jesus said in Matthew 26:52, he who lives by the sword dies by the sword. So there's some people that are just going to go a certain way, a certain path, and they dictate that path by how they choose to live or how they choose to obey or how they choose to believe. Here's the perseverance and the faith of the saints. In other words, the idea here is, as I said, that they are going to be preserved not by warfare, not by the sword. They're going to be persevere through their faith in God. In other words, it's kind of an indirect way of saying the saints are not to take up arms here and fight this imperial power to defend themselves. The saints are going to put their trust in God to fight for them. Really, this is God's war. The saints are the casualties, it's true. And they're also the ones that are going to be protected to some extent. But it's God's war. It's really Satan declaring war against God. And then we have this other beast coming up out of the earth. Out of the earth is different than out of the sea. Out of the earth has to do with the source of this beast's power or the source of this beast's form of worship. And really, this is pagan worship here. And any time we talk about pagan in its true definition, we're talking about something that is nature worship or worship of natural things. Just like the Egyptians did with their worship. The Egyptians worshiped the sand, the river Nile, the sea, the sun, the moon, death. You know, they worshiped all kinds of natural things there, things of the natural world. So it's not surprising that this beast comes out of the earth. And what does the beast promote here but a pagan religion, things of this earth? In this case, even people. People who are of this earth. That is what he wants to have everyone worship. He has two horns like a lamb and spoke as a dragon. So he's disguised. He's portraying himself as someone to be trusted. I mean, like a lamb and yet speaks like a dragon. Kind of like what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7, you know, the wolves in sheep's clothing. Kind of a, you imagine a wolf, and you've seen pictures on, you know, the internet, I'm sure, where you've got a wolf that's got kind of a sheep, you know, clothing or sheep wool over its head there, posing as though we're harmless and trusted and trustworthy and so on. And that's exactly what's going on here. This beast here, this what's later identified as the false prophet, you know, he's wanting people to trust him. We also have another mockery here, probably with the two horns idea, imagery here, and that is we have Jesus, who is the union of two offices. Remember that? Which offices are they? The king and the high priest. And so we have the two offices here united here, and in this case, it's not the kingdom and high priest, or king and high priest, as much as you might say, it's the political and religious authority, which is a generic and an inferior way of what Jesus is. So again, we have this mockery or this inferior representation, and this beast then is just another fake entity. Okay, it's a fake religion. Now I'm in the notes here on page 14. The second beast or false prophet supports and seemingly legitimizes this beast or the state and its emperor. So there's a false religion. Remember what I said about Domitian? He thought he was a god. And so there's this false religion that surrounds him, this cult-like religion that surrounds him that is being used to promote and propel this idea of him being a divine being. Now, that doesn't mean everyone believes in it. But it doesn't mean either that people aren't going to at least openly and publicly accept it for the sake of their own preservation. Remember, most people are believing in things not because they really believe in them, but because they're trying to save their own neck. And that is really what's going on here. So he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence. He makes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose fatal wound was healed. So he performs great signs. We think of these as actual miracles, but they're no doubt false miracles or deceptions. And Rome and the Roman Empire and people of Rome used a great deal of deceptions in order to con people and to get them to believe in what they were saying was true. I am hesitant to say anything about the last couple of years and all the stuff that has been coming out from our political and, shall I say, medical authorities about things that they said were true that weren't, that has been coming out over and over now, that they lied, they lied, they lied. But we trusted them, see? And so... this is kind of the same thing. There's a lot of lying going on, but people trust it because it's a powerful person or a powerful entity or a powerful position. And so there's a great conning here, a great deception going on here. So you've got these two powers. You've got the political power of the beast itself, and then you've got this, for lack of a better word, this religious power. Okay, this pagan power that is supporting the beast. They're both supporting each other. They're both kind of feeding off of each other. And they're both kind of coming to the same conclusion. And that is that the God in heaven is either powerless to stop us or is insignificant or irrelevant. God's people are interference and need to be stamped out. We are the real power. You need to listen to us. You need to believe in us. And if you don't, well, then, you know, it may cost you your life if you don't. None of us have ever been, that, to my knowledge, here in a situation where someone either literally or figuratively put a gun to our head and say, you're going to do it this way or not. But if you don't, then it's going to cost you your life. I mean, that's just an awful scenario to even think about. And yet that's what these people, the church, was faced with here. He deceives, and this is what it's all about, is deception, sleight of hand, pulling the wool over the people's eyes, giving lies as though they were truth, and then making truth into lies. That's what these people did here, and telling those who dwell in the earth to make an image to the beast who had the wound and of the sword and has come to life. In other words, to immortalize him in a, like almost a statue or an image of some kind to bow down to him. And really, this is idolatry, right? I mean, that's what that is. It's just idolatry coming back to life. And it was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast would even speak and cause as many who do not worship who do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Well, if the head of the beast is the imperial power, then the image itself may well be the man who is the image, the man Domitian himself. In other words, if the imperial power, his position, is the head, then the man Domitian is the image. In other words, we're told, or these people are being told, you need to bow down before this man. And that is just, again, idolatry in its purest form right there. Some bad things going on here. And it's not over. There's more, right? Unfortunately, we're out of time. But just think about, again, what those Christians had to deal with, what they were faced with. This is not a simple scenario. This is not an avoidable scenario. This is something they're going to have to face head on. And God is saying, and I'll be with you, right? I mean, that's what he's saying. Christ is assuring them, I'm going to be with you this whole way, but it's going to get worse before it gets better. All right, we're going to have to quit with that. And for time's sake, we'll transition here.